It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. So, love. We talk about it a lot. Singers sing about it. Religions, philosophies try to define it. Author Anne Lamott has been thinking about love. In her newest book, she asks, what are we even talking about when we talk about love? What is it? Anne Lamott joins us now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What does love mean to you? How does love show up in your life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Anne Lamott is a novelist and nonfiction writer. She's an activist, public speaker, writing teacher. Her many books include Dusk, Night, Dawn on Revival and Courage. Her newest is called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Annie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
You start your book, Annie, with almost a sermon on love, what it is, how we live it in our lives. Talk us through what walked you down that path of figuring out what the heck love is.
Well, it all began about 5 years ago when the UN climate papers came out that said we had 12 years to turn around the catastrophe, the global catastrophe. And of course, we hadn't done anything. So a couple of years ago, I started thinking about what the future was going to be like for my son, Sam, and his son, who's in high school now, named Jax. And I decided to write a book about everything that had ever helped me before to come through really dark, cold, scary times. And about three pieces in, I discovered that all of them had somehow or other to do with love, like this energy, community love, or not the love of nature, the family love, which can be a little fraught, but also very sweet. And every piece had to do with love. So I suddenly found myself writing a book on love that I really wanted to leave behind for the two of them for when I'm gone, because I think their futures are going to be a little rough. So anyway, I asked this six-year-old boy in my Sunday school, I said, what do you think love is? And I said, oh, you know, it's this stuff. And I thought, that's right. It's this stuff. You know, it's affection. It's kindness. It's generosity. It's peace. It's sharing. It's quiet. It's all sorts of different things. It's ecstatic dancing in the park. It's romantic. It's the love of activists. It's the love of the community that's picking up litter on our beaches. It's the neighbor who used to not like me until, I think I told this story in the book. I'm old now. I turned 70 2 days ago.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I left the engine of my car running, and she'd always been very weird and cold with me. And about 3 hours later, she knocked on my door and said, you know, your engine's running. And I had to make it seem like I had meant for that to be. But I think she knew then that I'm not a scary person, anything but, and she's been really sweet and friendly to me ever since. She waves me down, flags me down, asks how I am. So love does not always look so lovely. But it's always our only hope.
We think sometimes of love as this grand, immersive, focused feeling on one person. You talk about finding love on a 10-minute walk in a small act of kindness. How can we lead with love in those small ways?
Well, it's a line of my husband's that everything that is true and beautiful can be found on a 10-minute walk. And so for me, a lot of the time when I'm not feeling love, and I think the world is dying of not love, usually at the hands of the fundamentalists of every single persuasion, except possibly the Buddhists. But we're sitting inside, and I'm sure you're fine, but I'm thinking of whose fault things are and who to blame. And I'm feeling this sort of victimized self-righteousness, which is the exact opposite of that feeling in your heart of warmth and kind of a quiet gratitude. And so I often take these 10-minute walks with my dog, and it's like hitting the reset button. I see the neighbor. I see 93-year-old Jesse, who's still taking his daily walk because people come by to help him. And I'm seeing the people whose dog is about 14 and who come to talk to me because my dog passed last year and they don't think they're going to be able to handle it emotionally. And I make time for them. And that's love. And the community is love. You know, the people that are fighting to provide housing for the elderly in my community and for the unhoused in my community and who are mentoring. It's just there if you decide to get out of the shutdown, sort of victimized self-righteousness, which is a condition I tend to gravitate towards.
Well, and I was thinking that too, Anne. In my self-conception, I'm not a petty or vindictive or judgmental person, and I would want to live that way, but my brain doesn't always get that memo. How can we get from that place of whatever our personal failings are that steer us away from love? How do you get yourself back onto that path?
Onto that path. Well, I know, I think I said about 10 times in the book, if you want to have loving feelings, which is what heaven is like, you have to do loving things. You have to pick up the phone and call your very strange but very lonely aunt and stay on the phone with her when she goes into full tilt weird. And you take things by. In Texas, they have this thing called porch presents that are just wrapped in newspaper and usually left anonymously on someone's porch who might be having a really low point. It's just a porch present. Even if it's not anonymous, you don't need to write a thank you letter because it's a porch present wrapped in newspaper. And that's an act of love. And if you do these things, it will change your whole day around. It's this magical equation, but it works. And also you get outside and you look up. You look away from your feet. You look away from all the things that are so annoying, and you look up. You look up. You don't look up and see the stars and go, "Oh, those are medium stars, whatever." Or as the young people say, "Whatever." And you don't look at the new baby moon and go, "Well, yeah, it's fine. I mean, I guess I prefer the full moon," because then you're apt to look at the full moon and go, "Oh, I wish it weren't so cloudy today," right? Instead, you look up and you go, "Wow," and you look up at the stars and you say, "Wow." My pastor told me years ago that you can trap bees on the bottom of mason jars without lids because they just walk around sort of bitterly bumping into the glass when all they have to do is to look up. So I have a bunch of these tools, these kind of homely, ordinary tools in my battered old toolbox of 70 years. And I do them. Sometimes to get back to the path of love, I pick up the 200-pound phone and I call one of two or three best friends and I say, "I am not okay. I hate everything and I'm scared to death." And they don't ever say, "Really, geez, you've written all these spiritual books and you pretend to be this way or that." They inevitably say, "Oh, I'm so glad you called. I was there yesterday. I hated everyone and all of life. Let me come get you. Let's go to Target." And that's what love looks like.
Anne Lamott is with us. We're talking about her latest book. It's called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Annie, I want to talk more about reaching out and community building. You have this great story. You were part of a church group. People are going to get together and figure out a big thing to do together. And they at first argued over what that big thing is. Can you talk us through that story and how people ended up?
Yeah, it's actually my friend Mark Iaconelli told me that his church group, the minister, who was a gay woman and an activist, just a beautiful soul, decided to start a church group of the radical Jesus. Well, that means, you know, there's this brown-skinned Jewish guy from the Middle East, and his message is take care of the poor. And so she summons people together, and a bunch of people show up. And she says, "What ideas do you have?" "Well, they're going to change the world. You know, they're going to do this. They're going to build showers for the homeless. And they're going to shut down the local right-wing radio station. And they're going to do 1,000 things." But they're all kind of getting worked up. You know, they're all like really uptight and saying this and that. And she says, "Oh, my God, you're just making me all so tired. I wish I hadn't started this group." And then one person said, she says, "Let's all go home and pray about it for a week. Meet me back here in a week." Well, about half the people come the following week and they start in again. "Well, I think we should do this." And of course, they all have an idea of who should be the leader of the group. And one of them says, why don't we talk about what the radical Jesus would look for each of us in our problems and our loneliness and our stuckness? And so then they came back the following week and one woman said, "Well, I'm really overweight and I won't walk, but I wonder if anybody in the group would walk with me several times a week." "Sure." A few hands go up. One woman said, I used to love having people over for dinner, and then I spaced out when I had people over last time, and I gave them food that they had told me made them sick. They were gluten free, and now I'm afraid. I wonder if anybody would come for dinner. Oh, well, all hands went up. And then my friend Mark Iaconelli said, "I just am so unconnected. I'm so busy. I have this toxic busyness and this toxic self-consciousness, and I just want a half an hour outside on the porch in quiet time and maybe prayer." And so then the minister said, "Oh, I'll come over. I'll take you, you know." So every time she called, he'd go, No, I'm too busy. Please don't come over. I'm just kind of not well enough for you to come over." To say, "Mark, I'm coming over. You don't have to meet me on the porch, but I'll be there." So there's a lot of stuff about community in this book, because you don't become fully human on your own. You don't sing harmony by yourself. You know, and it's scary for some of us that are shy or introverts, or to take that first step and to open a door where there's a group of people doing what you have longed to be a part of, whether it's singing, whether it's a choir, whether it's ecstatic dance, whether it's being a activist for women's rights, and you step in and you gasp, with horror. And you either think these people are just too odd for words, or something wrong with them, or you think what Groucho Marx always said, that he wouldn't want to belong to a group that would have him. And then you do this weird, scary, radical thing. You put out your hand and you say hello to someone. And a lot of life's richness begins with putting out your hand or looking someone in the eye and saying hello.
We are talking about love with Anne Lamott, novelist, nonfiction writer, and Sunday school teacher. Her new book is called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What thoughts do you have on love and how it works in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with author, activist, and teacher Anne Lamott, looking at her new book. It's called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Hello. Many, many, many years ago, I picked up a book called The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm. It was originally published in 1956. And I read this book, and this book, I believe, changed my life. Basically, the answer to human so the theory of love he's got in here, love is the answer to the problem of human existence. So basically, it's the separateness that we feel. And when we bridge that separateness, that's when we find love. And it could be love with anything, inanimate objects, with God, however you perceive him to be, with everything. Once we get that separateness away and we feel one with that, that's where love comes in. And it's a beautiful feeling once you experience it.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. I think I hear you nodding along, Anne.
Yep, I'm nodding along.
It seems, though, that a lot of times the way our society is trending, we have more and more solitary pastimes, less likely to go out and join that community. How do we turn that around and get that connection that Laura is talking about?
Well, first of all, I think that we start to learn not love by kindergarten, and we discover that loving and sharing and compassion and just loving eyes on the world, you don't get graded for. And that what you get graded for is kind of thrusting yourself ahead of the pack and raising your numbers and thinking that it's outside there, and that if you're a value to other people, then you will get love. It's transactional. That's how I was raised anyway. And for me, a lot of this began when I got sober, and horribly people said that I needed to learn somehow to start learning my loving my very, very disappointing self as best I could. I had to talk to me the way I talked to you. Now, I don't think we've ever met in person, although I've been on this show a few times. But if you told me something like, "Oh, you just feel hopeless about the future or about democracy," I wouldn't say, "Really? You're kidding me. Like, how old are you? You know, I would say, God, I know how that feels. I'm not there today, but I was actually there Monday. And what I did was I read Arlie Hochschild's book on finding love and connection with the people of MAGA in the bayou, you know, this sociologist from Berkeley, or a stranger in their own land, it's called. Oh, I read a bunch of poetry. I went outside. I took a 10-minute walk. I looked up. And you know what I did? I did a bunch of things that I think will contribute to the common good. Now, I grew up in the 50s and early 60s, and people used to talk about the common good, right? And you never hear that anymore. It's all like, pull up the ladder. I got mine. And so one way to feel that love is to express it or to activate it by doing things that help the community, that help the poor, that you send up whatever you can to Red Cross, or you have a garage sale and you send the money to Doctors Without Borders, or you register voters, or you go to the food pantry. You just fill up a bag of food. It could be a 20-minute commitment. You fill up a bag of food with really nice groceries and a sack of Oreos for the little ones, and you drive over to the Canal District where people are pretty underserved, and you give it to people. And then, you know, you flirt with them and you look people in the eye and you say, hey, how are you? Because people aren't looking at them and saying, hey, how are you? You go to Whole Foods, and you stand in line, and the guy in front of you is very old, and he's got 30 items in his basket and coupons, right? And instead of counting his items thoughtfully and making these bad noises of sighing and whatnot, you say to him, I love your hat. Or you say to him, can I pet your dog? Is she friendly? Or you say to him, how are you doing today? And then you've brought love. And so love exists around you, and it can change the whole emotional acre that you're standing on.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us calling from the road. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you guys? It's a great program, but I have to be the person that causes the problem. I think, to some degree, with all due respect to the author, that the concept being expressed is one which diminishes what we really originally thought about, or at least I did as a youngster growing up and having very loving parents, that love is not about the scenery on the road. It's not about whether you do some work on the side for charity. Those are all matters of respect and kindness, and there's nothing wrong with those words. But to suddenly take the word love, in my opinion, and spread it across the board like it's some magical cure, I don't buy that theory, and that's what it sounds like is being offered. I regret that I haven't read the author's book, so, you know, my comments may be inappropriate, but
Tom, I gotcha. Tom, Annie, are we diluting our concept of love if we spread it so thin, Tom worries?
I don't think you can spread love thin. It's not spreadable, and it can't be thin. It's just love. It's just what it is, and there are a lot of pieces in the book about family and our closest, most intimate friends, and that is where we find safety, and that's where we find our sense of value, and that's where, in my case, these few very best friends and my brothers are the reason I have such faith in God, is because of that love in my immediate galaxy. So I think it might be useful if you read the book, because it's I really hear what you say, but that's not what the book is like.
Tom, thanks for that call. Anne Lamott is with us. That new book is called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Christine joins us now in Eau Claire. Christine, hi. Are you there, Christine? I think we lost Christine. We'll go instead to Chris in Cedarburg. Chris, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, you know, I kind of feel that today's youth and some people, you know, when they get married, expect their spouse to be picture perfect, or, you know, maybe look or act like they did when they first got married. And I think, as we all know, as we age, you know, you are going to lose some of that sparkle and get realistic. And, you know, it's up to you to be there for your love, you know, for your husband or wife. And be there through good times and bad, and really good times and bad, when, you know, maybe there's an illness and you know, someone who stays with you through the turmoils and, you know, the ups and downs. To me, that's, you know, true love, along with, like she was saying, the grocery store. I'm one to say, hey, can I help you, you know, take your cart back? Or, you know, you just got to express yourself and be there.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Eddie, you talk about some of the ups and downs in your own relationship. A lot of love is working through those not so perfect times.
Yeah. And, you know, just back to what the last man was saying, he said he grew up in a very, very loving family and that it was a source of safety. And I would say that 2/3 of the people that come to my talks or that read my books didn't grow up with parents that loved each other and loved each other equally and felt women were equal to men. And the people who I'm close to and the people who tend to like my work grew up with a lot of anxiety and fear. They might have looked different. They might have, like me, I looked very different. I got bullied a lot. My parents didn't like each other at all. And so I didn't get a handbook on love and what it is. I needed to find chips of tile for the mosaic that I crafted of love in its many splendored things. And a lot of us were taught, I certainly was, by, I had an English mother and a father who was the son of a Presbyterian missionary, God's frozen chosen, which I actually am now too, but they were so guarded and they were so focused on looking good and on impressing people. And my friend Duncan Trussell, the comedian, said that when you first meet him, you're meeting his bodyguard, and that we're just so, so, so protected. And so it's hard to let love get in by osmosis, that we stop being permeable at a certain age because we know it's just going to lead to hurt. And so I think a lot about a lot of this book is about the courage to be loved. The whole last chapter is based on that beautiful William Blake line of poetry that says, we are here to learn to endure the beams of love, because some of us are just great at loving everyone, loving the world. I was like a little flight attendant to my whole family when I was growing up. And but to endure the beams of love, to let people love me to within an inch of my life, well, I'll tell you, that took some work, that took practice. And every time I let it happen, it was like doing Nautilus for my soul.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to Anne Lamott for joining us. Her new book is called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday, and today we're doing something a little different. Usually we bring you advice on how to cook with recipes, ingredients, techniques, and inspiration. Today we're going in the other direction, how not to cook. You are our guest. We are hoping you'll share your stories of cooking gone wrong. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us about that dish that just didn't come out right, the mistake you made, the guess that you were hoping would work that didn't, the experiment that went horribly, horribly wrong. Hopefully there's a happy ending, and maybe you learned a thing or two from it. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Back in January, we were talking about spices with Patrick O'Halloran, author of The Care and Keeping of Spices. Aaron in Stoughton called in to share this story.
A young wife, many years ago, very early in the marriage, knew that I liked meatloaf, got a recipe from her mother. Well, my new wife did not like the texture of celery, so she substituted the celery, 1 cup, for celery salt.
Hold on, one it cup of celery salt?
Yes.
How was that?
I guess that would render that inedible.
It was pretty much inedible, but it was something that we can still laugh about.
I bet. I hope so.
There's a story like that in my family, but I think the meatloaf went flying across the room and hit the wall.
I think a lot of us have stories like that. You could share yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Got an email from Leon who writes, when I first cooked scrambled eggs, I used to wait until all the egg liquid turned solid before turning off the heat. The result, near burnt or crusty eggs. Then I met my nephew-in-law 10 years later who was studying at a culinary school. He told me it's a good practice to retain some of that liquid to ensure fluffier and tastier scrambled eggs. Sure enough, the magic worked. Nowadays, people line up for miles to try my cooking. I even perfected omelets after years of failure, all thanks to my nephew-in-law's mad skills. So there's one with a happy ending. Though my daughter, I don't know, I think she still likes them this way. She would cook her own eggs, and she wanted them brown and a little crispy. Yeah, nobody else in the house liked it. But how about you? What is your cooking story gone wrong? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Couldn't find the audio for this one. We did something like this years ago, and somebody called in with the story of when they were doing a fondue at home for the first time, and they were doing a chicken thing where you dipped it, I think, in hot cheese. And so she put the raw chicken on the skewers and dipped it in the cheese, thinking, I guess, the heat of the cheese was going to cook the chicken. It did not. Fortunately, I think nobody actually ate the slightly warmed up cheesy chicken. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Tim joins us in Milwaukee. Hi there, Tim.
Hello.
Hi, what's your story?
This wasn't something that I did. It was a friend of mine's mother who, even later, known for her culinary skills, but she had just gotten married and her in-laws were, she cooked dinner for them for the very first time. And while they're having a cocktail, she heard these funny noises from the kitchen, sort of a boom, 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 boom. Well, it was the potatoes exploding because she hadn't cooked it before. So she made twice mashed or twice baked potatoes out of them.
Oh, good. We got a happy ending out of the story there, which, Tim, thanks a lot for getting us started. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Scott joins us now in Spring Green. Scott, hi.
Hello.
What's the story,
quickly,
Scott?
The story is my folks, very young, newlyweds, the first thing that my mom cooked included a dessert, which was chocolate pudding. And my mother unknowingly scalded the milk for the chocolate pudding, served it up with pride to Dad. And Dad said, oh, what is this? This is terrible.
Oh, no.
And Mom proceeded to run into the bedroom crying.
Oh, no.
But the outcome is they're celebrating their 63rd wedding anniversary to each other. So they're still alive and happily married.
Wonderful, Scott. Well, and you came along, too. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, scalded milk. I don't think there's anything good about that. This is why I don't make a lot of pudding. Like, that, you got to keep stirring and stirring and stirring. Thanks for sharing that story, Scott. We've got Ryan now in Sun Prairie. Ryan, hi. What is your cooking gone wrong story?
Hi, yeah, a good day. When I was in Boy Scouts, we were on a camping trip one weekend, and my buddy was making tacos, and he read the 3/4 of a cup of water on the pack as 3 to 4 cups. So we had taco soup instead of taco meat.
How did you? That doesn't sound very convenient for camping to me. Did you have bowls and spoons?
Yeah, we, probably didn't have big enough bowls for soup, but you got through.
You make do. Ryan, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We are taking your stories of cooking gone wrong, mistake, bad outcome, maybe a lesson learned. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We got some stories from our colleagues here on Central Time. Beatrice writes, I once saw a TikTok that claimed you could make homemade Cheez-Its by baking cheese in the oven. So I took some deli sliced cheddar, cut it into 1-inch squares, punched a hole in the middle of each, very important, and threw them in the oven. When I took it out, it was, surprise, a puddle of cheddar cheese. Apparently, Cheez-It crackers are mostly made of flour. Beatrice says, lesson, don't believe every recipe you see on TikTok. Good lesson to take out of that. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Monique is with us in Plainfield. Monique, hi.
Hi. I actually have two stories. My favorite one from when I was fairly new to cooking. I knew that you poked potatoes to know when they were done when you were boiling. And so my assumption was that you do the same with eggs.
Oh, no.
And so the eggs never got done because I continued to poke them and they were always hard. Once I got very comfortable in the kitchen, my younger sister called me one day because she decided she wanted to make a Thanksgiving dinner and she wanted to know how long to cook her turkey. I asked her how many pounds was her turkey and she said, oh, I don't know, about 78. So I told her she needed a much bigger oven.
78 pound?
She thought that her turkey weighed 78 pounds.
Wow, I don't want to meet that turkey in the wild.
Right? I told her she needed a bigger oven.
Interesting. I hope it was like maybe 7.8 pounds. I don't know. Monique, thanks a lot for sharing those. I love it. I'm just glad you didn't poke the eggs too early in the pot. And then, yeah, you know what happens next. Karen joins us now in Rice Lake. Karen, hi, what's your story?
Hi. When I was first learning to cook just after getting married, I tried making gravy, and I just kept adding flour to the skillet, and it didn't seem to be thickening up right away, so I added more and more flour. And finally, I ended up with about a 3-inch rubber ball in the middle of the skillet.
Did you serve it up, or did you just toss it out?
My husband looked over my shoulder and said, that's not how my mom does it.
Well, maybe his mom could have taught him to make it. Did you tell him that? That's what I think.
Yeah, I think that would have been a good idea.
Karen, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. We've got Sarah with us now in Green Bay. Hi there, Sarah.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my phone call.
What's your story, Sarah?
I was a new mom, and I had a little toddler outside. We were playing, and I had put eggs on the stove to boil, and I forgot about them.
Oh, no.
And the next thing I knew outside, I heard this popping, strange popping noise, and it still didn't connect as to what it was. And all of a sudden, it connected. I ran inside. The water had gone down to the very bottom of the pan, and the eggs were exploding out of the pan, hitting the ceiling, and I had smoke, raw, like gross smoke,
egg smoke. Oh yeah, a little brimstone sulfur smell around. How long did it take for that smell to go away?
Oh, a good probably week to almost 2 weeks.
Well, you're outside gardening, so it must have been nice weather so you could open up. Sarah, thanks a lot for sharing that story. We are taking your calls, your stories of cooking gone wrong, famous cooking mistakes, maybe ones you hopefully still laugh about to this day. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We are taking your stories of cooking mistakes, kitchen experiments gone wrong. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We asked around here at WPR on the Central Time team. Rochelle Wilson shares this story.
So there's an infamous kitchen disaster story in my relationship, and I did get permission to share this on air. In the early days of dating, my partner was not a very good cook. One night, I requested that he make pesto pasta with zucchini. He went and got the supplies and came back and made the dish. Only what he served me was a bowl of pasta with hot, soggy cucumbers. Yes, cucumbers. Not only had he grabbed the wrong vegetable at the store, but he went ahead and chopping, cooking it, not thinking anything of it. I love cucumbers and pickles, but this was almost inedible. I still give him grief about it to this day. During the pandemic, he took up cooking, and now he's a great home chef who makes some of my favorite meals around, but he'll never live the cucumber fiasco down.
Back to your calls now. We've got Jim with us in Platteville. Jim, hi.
Hey. Yeah, Rob. I had a little cooking disaster go wrong. I was making a homemade pizza, and well, I had the Italian sausage and the dough all made and everything, and I thought, you know, some mozzarella cheese would go well. Mm-hmm. So I looked in the freezer and I grabbed a package of shredded mozzarella. So I sprinkled it all over the top of it, and put it in the oven, waiting for my wife to come home. And I was so proud of myself. And I opened up the oven when it was about done, and something didn't smell quite right. And it wasn't melting quite right. Well, lo and behold, here it wasn't shredded mozzarella. It was coconut. And lo and behold, the pizza didn't taste so well. So
you did try it, though.
Yeah, yeah. No, I did a little bit, but it wasn't any new invention or anything. You know, it went in the garbage. But, yeah, we still talk about it today.
I bet. Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that story. I know people argue about pineapple on pizza. Maybe that's as far as we can take tropical fruit on our pizza. Thank you so much for sharing that, Jim. We've got Ellen with us now in Birchwood. Ellen, hi.
Hi. I was in about junior high or high school when I thought I'd do a little baking at home when my parents were gone. And I didn't realize that confectioner's sugar is different than granulated. So the frosting came out a little grainy, but my dad was supportive and ate it anyway.
See, I'm sure you are not the only person who's ever done that one, Ellen. I think a lot of people have swapped those for each other, and it'll still come out tasting okay, right?
Right, just you got to chew it a little bit more.
A little chew here. Ellen, thanks a lot for sharing that. We are taking your stories of cooking gone wrong. The famous story, maybe you still tell it to family and share it with posterity. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls. Leah is with us in Sauk County. Leah, hi.
Hi. Yeah, one of my famous stories is I was making my first pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving and didn't realize the pumpkin pie mix that I had used was already pre-spiced. And so then I went and added all the spices, like the cinnamon and clove. And when I went to taste it, it about burned my throat out because it was so overspiced. So just always it comes up every Thanksgiving, but a good reminder to always read the can of pumpkin to see if it's pre-spiced.
That is great advice. Did you just like load up so much whipped cream to balance out, or was it a?
It was inedible. It burned your throat so bad. So, but luckily I had a spare actual pumpkin puree can in the back of the cupboard, so it was saved.
Oh, excellent! Good. Leah, thanks for sharing that. Reminds me an acquaintance of mine who is a pretty good cook. Actually, one time made a peanut stew, but the recipe was for unsalted peanut butter at the start. He didn't realize he had salted peanut butter, so he had the salt and then the more salt, and it was edible, but it was pretty salty. So very similar to that story, Leah. Thank you so much. Janice joins us now in Antioch, Illinois. Janice, hi, what's your story?
Oh, I've got two. The first one is when I was making popcorn on the stove. And I decided to run out to go get the mail. And on the way back, I started pulling weeds and I forgot. And I came in the house and it was smoke all the way from about 4 feet up to the ceiling. And then the second one was even better. I was making spaghetti for the family. And we had bantam chickens that had fleas. And I had put flea powder in the Parmesan cheese shaker, and somebody put it on the shelf, and then we spread it onto the spaghetti, and of course it had to go out in the trash.
Did people like, what did flea powder spaghetti taste like?
Well, we didn't eat it.
Good. Yeah, that could have had a bad ending. Janice, thank you so much for sharing that one. I think there's a lesson there in not storing not food things in containers labeled as food things. Awesome story. And with the burning popcorn, there is, of course, the famous story at WPR of a certain staffer who ignited, or at least made their tacos very smoky in the microwave. It did indeed set off the smoke alarms. Can we call her Keely B? No, that's too odd. K. Baltina. Yeah, that's good and anonymous, right? Back to your calls now. Hansa is with us in Madison. Hansa, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your story?
So my parents had some friends, and the friends had a boat. And they all went out on the boat and had a great time and then came back to the house and had dinner. And my parents' friends cooked the dinner, and the wife made a beautiful glazed ham. And very shortly after eating through this meal, people became violently ill.
Uh-oh.
And it turns out that the wife thought that a jar of motor oil was molasses, and she had glazed the ham with the motor oil that her husband had brought back from the boat.
Oh, no. Wait, didn't it taste, you know, like it was ham glazed in motor oil? Like, didn't that tip people off?
Everyone was so blasted drunk that they were in no position to even complain. They were just shoving food in their mouths. And yeah, one guy ended up in the hospital. He lived, but he had to have his stomach pumped. My parents were like, we are never eating with them ever again.
Oh my God. Well, I'm glad everybody ended up okay. Yeah, it tastes a little smoky today, but I guess it's okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Wow. Okay, hold on. Yeah, I guess our producer, Colleen, who's taking your calls, is kind of losing it with laughter. Okay, we're going to hold it together. We are taking your calls with food experiments, food gone wrong, kitchen mistakes, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's going to be hard to top flea powder and motor oil, but you could try. We've got Roy calling on the road. Roy, hello.
Hey, good morning. Good afternoon. So, yeah, mine's not so funny to me anyway.
Uh-huh.
It's more of a safety thing. So even though I was in my 60s at a hotel, you know, limited protein options, and I'm not a big fan of hard-boiled eggs, but, you know, they had them, so I brought them to the room and cooked them in a microwave and took a bite, and it exploded in my face.
Oh, no.
And I got partial burns around my mouth and around my eye a little bit. Nothing to go to, you know, just first aid took care of it. But,
okay.
Yeah, it was my first experience of that. So anybody that doesn't know this, like I found out the hard way, please cut a boiled egg in half before you put it in the microwave so it doesn't. The yolk basically steamed up, got built up pressure around and underneath the white of the egg that was solidified. So.
That is great advice. Yeah. I worry about harming myself with the microwave too sometimes. You get that pocket of super heat. You know, the hot pockets or whatever, you don't want that cheese burn, certainly. Thanks for sharing that, an important safety lesson there, Roy. I will go now to Helen in Manitowoc. Helen, hello.
I'm good. I mean, hello there. my experience was with smoke also. I was making beef vegetable soup, and I started the bones and put them on a kettle on my electric stove in a big kettle, not a soup kettle, but a heavy bottom thing. And threw my daughter in the stroller and went downtown to Crazy Days for a couple hours. But I thought I had turned it down to low to let it simmer, but I hadn't. So it stayed on high the whole while I was gone. When I came back, there was smoke just quietly flowing down the edge of the pan and across the top of the stove and down to the floor, just a layer of smoke. And I quietly went over and just shut the burner off and went back outside because I was afraid. It smoked up the curtains, the drapes so bad in the house that they never lost the smoky smell.
Wow.
The neighbor downstairs invited us for supper that night. And my husband was a little upset, but my mother-in-law bought me a new kettle.
Excellent. Helen, thanks for sharing that with us. Time for, I think one more. Chris is with us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I have a funny story. I worked at a real nice restaurant that served prime rib, and I was a new cook there. But I came into my shift and put the prime rib in. A couple hours later, my coworker comes in and he looks at it and he said, "That doesn't look like prime rib." And I was like, mm-hmm. "Oh, I think that's a New York strip loin."
Oh no!
So that evening, we sold slow roasted New York strip loin instead of prime rib, but we did sell out and it ended up working out fine.
Oh, good. You got to keep the job, Chris?
I did.
Excellent. Well, it's good to know sometimes even the pros go wrong. Thank you so much, everybody. So many great stories to share when it comes to bad cooking. And the great thing is so many of you called in. I didn't have to share any of my cooking gone wrong stories. And I've got a few. Hey, you can keep sharing your stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Still time to participate in Food Friday's cooking gone wrong experience. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, dig into a key moment in the politics of civil rights in U.S. history with a look at Hubert Humphrey's efforts to pressure the Democratic Party to bring that issue onto their platform. Check that conversation out. Learn a key piece of American history. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Regular listeners know I'm a fan of nature webcams, looking at the brown bears at a national park in Alaska in particular. Those don't go live for a couple months yet, but here's a webcam where you can watch and help out by ringing a fish doorbell. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, a lot of fish migrate through waters in the city of Utrecht in the Netherlands, but they got to stop and wait for this lock to open. And early in the spring, not a lot of boats there, so the wait gets long, potentially dangerous. The solution, the fish doorbell. People around the world can watch an underwater webcam. When a fish appears, they can click a button ringing the doorbell. That alerts local ecologists that the fish are lining up. When they get enough fish, they give the lock operator the heads up to open up the lock and let the fish through. Last I checked, there were over 1,000 people watching. No fish at that point, but they do have a collection of pictures and videos. Hopefully that can hold my interest until the Alaska bears wake up. Hibernation time. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott. Last month, the Federal Trade Commission released a report showing that food prices and profits for big retailers stayed high even after pandemic-era supply chain disruptions were resolved, and that prices were boosted higher than increased costs would have justified in the first place. This came after the FTC sued to block a merger between Kroger and Albertsons, two major grocery chains, saying that the merger would raise food prices and lower wages for grocery workers. Experts have been warning for years that grocery consolidation in the U.S. is having serious consequences for our food system and our pocketbooks. Our next guests have been following the issue closely. They're here to talk about how big grocery chains are continuing to drive up food prices and what comes next. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you have a lot of options for where to shop and get food? Or did some kind of big supermarket chain come into town and drive out the older, smaller grocery stores? Do you own or work at a grocery store? How have things changed at your job since the pandemic? And if you are involved in selling food to distributors and stores, do you find that there aren't a lot of options, not a lot of competition for your product? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ben Murray is a senior researcher at Food and Water Watch. He has a master's degree from UW-Madison. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Eric Schlosser is an investigative journalist and contributor to The Atlantic. He's the author of Fast Food Nation and producer of the new documentary, Food, Inc. 2. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote, Eric, about this in The Atlantic recently. Talk us through. You think the FTC report mentioned what was driving these costs here. You think they could have taken it a step further and looked at the impact of industry consolidation in groceries and in food production and distribution?
I think the Biden administration is doing a good job at reviving the whole notion of antitrust enforcement, which has really been dormant for the last 40 years or so. And what needs to happen now is the public needs to be aware of how concentrated this power is, not only in the food system, but throughout our economy. But when it comes to food, if you've got a concentrated monopolistic system controlling food, it affects workers, producers like the dairy farmers of Wisconsin, but also the land and livestock. So food is the most important industry, and this is a very good place to start.
And Ben, this is an issue you've been following for some time now. This new FTC report looked at these issues, especially through the pandemic. As you look at their findings, what are you thinking about?
Yeah, they really just bring to light the fact that we have a for-profit food system, which isn't a surprise to hear. But after something like the pandemic, you know, we see that in a different light. And the FTC findings really point out practices that large food specifically grocery chains can enforce throughout the supply chain to increase profits and really harm consumers at all points.
And Eric,
and you know, one thing I'd like to just throw in to your listeners is, when you're looking for a supermarket, you may think there's an enormous amount of competition between all these brands. But one of the reasons the FTC is trying to block the merger between Kroger's and Albertsons is Kroger controls about 25 different grocery store brands, and Albertsons controls almost as many. So you think there are dozens of different stores, but it's really only one or two companies.
And Ben, similar things are true when it comes to stuff we find in the stores, right? Can you talk about what might appear to be a huge amount of choice coming down in many categories to just a couple few companies?
For sure. Yeah, we know companies like General Mills, Nabisco, Nestle, you know, we think similar to what, as Eric mentioned, about your choice with your consumer choice for store. A lot of the choices that we seem to make as we browse the aisle really go into the same companies. And a great example of this is the grain trade. You have four, it's called the ABCD. It's the four largest grain traders account for 90% of the global grain trade, which, you know, when we think about cereals and other types of foods that are really staples, the fact that 90% of the trade is controlled by four companies really shows the lack of choice we have as consumers a lot of the time.
Now, Eric, we produce a bit of food here in Wisconsin in terms of growing, raising it, and our food processing business is really big here. Is this something that's affecting not just consumers, but some of those primary producers, that lack of options of who to sell their stuff to?
Yeah, you know, I looked up some statistics from Wisconsin right before coming on this show, and I knew that the dairy industry was really getting hit, and it's shocking. I mean, I'm a pretty old guy, but I'm not centuries old. And when I was born, there were about 105, 110,000 dairy farms in Wisconsin. And now there's, let me just look at this number, there's 5,600. So that means that in my lifetime, Wisconsin has lost about 95% of its dairy farms. And this has huge consequences because we're talking about the survival of rural economies. And when you look at what's happened to the heartland of America, there's been a hollowing out as one town after another loses its population. And the profit is being kept by the middlemen, by the processors. And the people who are being sacrificed are the producers, like dairy farmers or cattle ranchers or hog farmers, but also the workers who work at these processing plants. So, you know, so much of this is hidden from view of consumers in the cities, but the people who live in rural America know this story all too well.
Talking to Eric Schlosser, journalist, author of Fast Food Nation, producer of the brand new documentary Food Inc. 2, and Ben Murray, senior researcher at Food and Water Watch, talking about concentration in the food industry. Whether you're talking about producers, distributors, grocery stores, you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences as a consumer. Do you feel like there are fewer grocery options for you out there? If you are in the food business on the other side of things, what are you seeing? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ben, one story people might think is, okay, a new big grocery store comes into town. They've got an economy of scale. Prices are lower. Too bad. Some of the competition might go out of business. That's capitalism. We're ultimately benefiting with these lower prices. What do you say to that story?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot going on there. And the bigger stores do come in and offer lower prices, but that can have downstream effects in the economy. You know, a lot of rural areas now rely on Walmart for food, and which they have a huge control over, you know, rural access to food. But, you know, they don't pay their workers as well as, you know, because people who make wages are also people who buy stuff. So, you know, if they're not getting paid enough, they're having a hard time to afford the food in the first place. And then once these companies, you know, do consolidate like the Kroger and Albertsons were trying to do, they can later down the line raise prices once they have a control over the market there.
Yeah, I'd like to just make a comment about mm-hmm. prices. Firstly, the cheap price of this industrial food is an illusion. And that was really the whole point of my book, Fast Food Nation, which is almost 25 years ago. There are so many business costs and external costs these companies are imposing on society. I mean, in California, there's been a lot of protests about how fast food workers have gotten a minimum wage increase. And, you know, the industry has been attacking that. But before the minimum wage increase of this year, the typical fast food worker in California was earning $15,000 a year. And about a third of them were on public assistance. And when you have workers who are earning such low wages that are on public assistance, that means taxpayers are paying for the health care and the food stamps of these workers. And we can just go through all the environmental costs that aren't reflected in the price at the market. And then one more thing on my rant, and I will be quiet. You know, when you're going to buy a car, if you have sufficient income, you know, there was a car that's no longer made called the Yugo. It was the cheapest car. It was really not a good car. There was a Ford Pinto. And people who have money will buy a Volvo over a Ford Pinto. And the reason there's such emphasis on the cheapness of our food is that the middle class has been squeezed in this country for about 40 years. And the minimum wage has not been increased at the federal level in 15 years. It's $7.25 an hour. When you look at how affluent people spend their money, they spend a lot of money on food because they know it's good for them. They want to get higher quality food. So we want to increase the wages of ordinary Americans so that they can pay for good food. And that will be so much less expensive to society than having poverty wages and highly processed food that costs so much in healthcare costs later on in life.
Talking to Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, producer of the new documentary Food, Inc. 2, and Ben Murray, senior researcher at Food and Water Watch, with us for a look at how consolidation at many levels of the food industry affects consumers and why it kept prices higher maybe than they needed to be during the pandemic and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you been affected by high food prices? Have you had to start shopping in a different store, switch brands, switch products, or take something off the shopping list completely? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about a new Federal Trade Commission report on the grocery supply chain, how consolidation in the industry is fueling high prices we're seeing at the checkout. Investigative journalist Eric Schlosser is with us, author of Fast Food Nation, producer of the new documentary Food, Inc. 2, and Ben Murray from Food and Water Watch. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Eric, before we go to our callers, Food, Inc. 2, I've mentioned it is out literally, I believe today is the release date. You mentioned you've been covering these issues for over a couple decades now. Why now with a new Food, Inc.?
You know, I wrote that book, Fast Food Nation, almost 25 years ago, and I've written articles and I've done some investigative pieces since then, but I really haven't been focusing my energy on food issues. I care about them a great deal. I try to be useful. But what led us, Michael Pollan, myself, and the director, Robbie Kenner, and Melissa Robledo, it was the pandemic. When we saw the news reports about, you know, thousands of hogs being slaughtered and dumped into ditches because the processing system was breaking down and milk being dumped and long lines of people waiting at grocery stores for food. The pandemic showed how fragile this industrial system is. And when you have this much concentrated power, one small thing can lead to food shortages. And, you know, we look at it in the film, but I really did a deeper dive for The Atlantic this week on the infant formula shortage. There were problems at one infant formula factory in America, and suddenly one fifth of the infant formula was taken off the market. And that is the sign of an overly concentrated oligopoly, because you should have dozens of companies making infant formula, not four that control 99% of the market. And, you know, if these formula companies go offline, infants can't eat. It's really as simple as that. So to me, the pandemic, and to Michael Pollan and my other collaborators, the pandemic really showed us how concentrated and fragile the system had become.
Let's go to our callers now. Sarah is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Oh, my God. Well, yeah, of course, everything is so much more expensive, and I've had to, like, start buying really cheap cheese instead of the more high-quality cheese I used to buy. But I wanted to say, I wanted to ask, I used to work at Jewel, which is an Albertsons store, and they have benefits for their employees. They're unionized, a good wage, and I'm wondering if the merger went through, what would happen to their employees?
Ben, do you have thoughts on if that Albertsons merger, which includes Jewel, went through with Kroger, which includes, as Eric said, a lot, the possible impact on employees there?
Yeah, I can't speak specifically to the – I'm not sure exactly, but I know that prior to the merger, Kroger and Albertson have been – there are allegations of the two kind of blackballing employees that were standing up against the potential merger. As far as what the union has done about the merger, I'm not sure. I know that one of the larger grocery store employee unions did not speak out explicitly against the merger, and there has been some backlash about that. But, you know, the consolidation, the merger, if it does go through, would probably put a squeeze on the employees, as a number would probably be let go if the stores were to merge together.
Thanks.
And I'll just throw in, there's no question that there would be grocery stores shut down. Yeah. And one of the answers has to be unionizing Walmart, because the grocery stores that are paying good wages, union wages, provide benefits, have to compete against Walmart, which has been extremely anti-union. So there's just been a lowering of wages and a proportion of the money that people spend going to workers, and that has to change.
Thanks again for that call.
Sorry,
go ahead, Ben. Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing to say about, you know, substituting a cheaper cheese or something like that, and what Eric said earlier about the middleman thing, a lot of these shortages are really exacerbated by the financialization of our food system, which, you know, in some instances, for every 1 pound of real wheat that is traded on a market, there's 15 or 20 trades of speculative activity from financial houses that are trying to profit off of basically every type of commodity that we have. And so, like Eric mentioned, like the middlemen, because they're almost countless in this example, are really, you know, trying to make the most of that. And in the pandemic time, we saw a huge spike in speculative trading, and there's loopholes that allow that currently in regulation, or lack thereof.
Talking to Ben Murray from Food and Water Watch and Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, producer of the new documentary Food Inc. 2, about consolidation in the food industry at all levels, what it means for people who work in those industries and people who eat food and buy food. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Platteville. Bob, hi.
How you doing today? And thanks for taking my call. My question is you talk about the government looking at these monopolies in the food industry. The beef packing industry has been controlled by four companies for years, and there have been people in the industry that are begging the government to look into it, and nothing ever seems to get done.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
That's a great point. I mean, Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle over a century ago about the Beef Trust. This was this enormous corporation that controlled the distribution of beef in the United States. Well, four companies control 85% of the market for beef right now, and that's greater power than over 100 years ago when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle. But none of this is inevitable, because during the 20th century, thanks to antitrust enforcement, by the 1970s, the top four beef companies controlled about 23-24% of the market. You had a competitive market for beef that really benefited cattle ranchers. And from about 1980 onward, these companies got bigger and bigger and bought up their competitors. And now if you're a rancher and you're trying to bring cattle to market, there may only be one bidder, two bidders, and what that allows is for a greater percentage of the profits to go to these companies. So yes, we've got to break up these big meatpacking companies and restore competitive markets.
I think we've got a caller with an example. Merle is with us in Galena, Illinois. Merle, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Yes, I had the radio off, but I just caught a little bit of that. So my experience has been I have a sheep herd, and I have to drive, in some cases, 2 hours to market them. And there's people in the neighborhood that I could sell them to, you know, by the halves or whatever. But there's no USDA meat packers capable of taking a herd. I have to take, I'd have to schedule them 8 at a time, 2 years ahead of time, which sounds pretty bizarre. I've never done it, but that's the only way I can get a spot where I can get a few head, you know. So I've been taking them to Fenimore, down into Iowa, 2 hours below Iowa City. It's a catastrophe, really.
Moreau, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for calling. I don't have a lot of time left. Ben, what Eric was talking about, some possible solutions here. What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, well, and like to what Eric said, like this, a lot of this deregulation is still going on. I mean, in 2018, the Trump administration eliminated GPSA, which is the Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyards Administration, which is an independent body in the USDA that kind of overlooks a lot of the rights that the Packers and Stockyards Acts enforce, you know, which is protecting producers from kind of exploitative contracts from these big four companies that do the meat. So there's even deregulation that's been going on in the past few years that we can try to undo and help those producers out.
Thanks for that call, Merle. In our last minute or so, Eric, do you see any positive signs of change, of moving in a different direction?
I do. I think the more people are aware of what's going on, the more they get involved in the process, the more they change their purchasing decisions. And I just want to make clear, what we've been talking about has nothing to do with free market capitalism. What's been going on in this country for the last few decades is socialism, corporate socialism, where you have huge financial donations being given by these companies to elected officials that eliminate the freedom, really, of farmers and consumers to operate in a free market.
We'll leave it there. Eric, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Been talking to Ben Murray, senior researcher at Food and Water Watch, and Eric Schlosser, an investigative journalist, author of the book Fast Food Nation. He's a producer of the new documentary released today. It's called Food Inc. 2. Been talking about a new federal report on how major supermarkets benefited from pandemic prices and why we're likely to continue seeing higher prices at the grocery store and maybe difficult working conditions for people in the food industry because of consolidation at pretty much every level of the food industry. If you have a story to share, you can let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a patient who was receiving vital plasma donations tracked the supply to a big business and to the donors, in some cases, some of the most vulnerable people in the United States. Find out what she learned in the new book called Blood Money. And there's a lot of great stuff to do here in Wisconsin. Some famous, sure, but some a lot off the beaten path. We'll get some inspiration and advice with the author of the new book, 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. Share your off-the-beaten-path place right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, author Anne Lamott is with us to talk about her new book. It's called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.